Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important, fastest growing, and now largest segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, economic, academic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they're counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, which will review the news over the next 2 hours and then turn our attention to absolute proof that Paul, the founder of the Christian religion, the author of half of the Christian New Testament, was a fraud. That number, toll free, 877-376-45. Dateline Ferguson, Missouri. The Reverend Al Sharpton, who's one of my least favorite people, pressed police in the community just a short drive north of St. Louis to release the name of an officer who fatally shot an unarmed black teenager in a suburban St. Louis community. You know, the police in Ferguson haven't even released the name of the officer who killed this young boy. I mean, now that it's known for absolute certain that the young man was unarmed, now that it's known for absolute certain, because there was a witness, the other party in this situation, that he was shot with his hands in the air. They were just walking down the street, and that the police belligerently, as they did the woman in Tucson, Arizona, the black college professor. Now, her race would be irrelevant if it wasn't for the fact that the cop was white. That under these circumstances, it is unconscionable that the police officer's identity would be held. Hey, this is a free society. You know, you don't have the right to hide that kind of information. A young man who just graduated from high school and was going on to college was killed by somebody who was paid by the community, using a weapon that was supplied by the community. You don't have the rights to privacy. Do you know that the St. Louis area, the Ferguson County, if it is Ferguson County, but the county surrounding Ferguson, just north of St. Louis, and for those that don't know, St. Louis is one of my least favorite places in the world to drive through. Now, it's not the world's ugliest city. The downtown is actually quite pretty. But at least on the north, south, and west, St. Louis goes on forever. And so there really is no distinguishing line between this is St. Louis and this is now a suburb. It's one of those places that if you're driving from east to west or west to east, and that's one of the major interstate routes, that you know that driving through St. Louis, unless you plan your time of drive for late in the evening, that it's going to cost you several hours because the roads are so bad in that part of the country. Now, been there many times, and I'm telling you that the St. Louis supervisors asked the FAA to put a ban for 1 week on all flights below 3,000 feet anywhere near St. Louis. What they're saying is, we don't want anyone to be able to film the interactions between police officers and the community. It's in an uproar over this. And for the most part, the community is behaving appropriately. They're doing peaceful protests. They're getting on their knees and putting their arms in the air, demonstrating their affinity for the young man that was killed. And yet the authorities there don't want anyone to see what's happening. It's almost like we're going back to Syria where there's no media, you know, where barbaric behavior happens outside of the prying eyes of the world. And we wanted to have that be the case of St. Louis, Missouri. This is two very, very troubling issues. Now, police said that the death threats prompted them to withhold the name of the officer who was placed on administrative leave after fatally shooting the 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, where the incident has stoked racial tensions, rallies, and one night of minor looting. Investigators have released for few details, which is also unconscionable. I mean, this isn't their right to choose what they're going to share. This is a free society. They work for us. We're their boss. Now, they think just the other way, which is the belligerency now of the police state that we've developed in America. But it's just inexcusable for them not to have released details, saying only that a scuffle unfolded after officers asked Brown and another teen to get out of the street. At some point, the officer's weapon fired inside a patrol car. I told you that while there were lots of different accounts of what occurred, and the eyewitness account that Scott shared in our program yesterday, that this sounded a lot like the video I saw of the abusive Tucson, Arizona cop who told the professor at the University of Arizona to get out of the street and to present her ID. And she was only in the street because there was construction that blocked the sidewalk. And she said no. And he says, you have no choice. That sounds like, you know, a military state. Present your ID. No, I'm just walking down the street. I'm not bothering anybody. Get out of my way. Go bother somebody else. Sounds like exactly what happened here. And, you know, there are people like myself, and I can't tell how many others of you there may be, that don't have a respect for authority, that distrust authority, rightfully so, and that we're not going to respond favorably to a cop telling us to show them our ID, to come over and be questioned by them, to be in their presence, to be interfered with by them, to be told to put up our hands, to be told to lay on the ground. No. We're going to respond very negatively to that. And these two young boys, these two teenage boys, may well have responded negatively to it. And if they did, I'm sorry that he's dead, but good for him. He did the right thing. We need more people to have backbone and fewer people to be compliant. The fact that too many people are compliant is a huge part of why America is in such a mess. Not enough people are willing to stand up. Now, I don't know. There's no video. And I don't know what these boys responded like. But I have watched the African-American woman professor at the University of Arizona and in Tucson. And I've listened to the cop and I've listened to her. And I envision a very similar set of circumstances. The facts that we do have indicate that is similar. Now, she was not killed, but she did the right thing. She had a backbone. More Americans need, in fact, more people around the world need a backbone to stand up against abusive institutions which have become counterproductive. Yesterday, I reported that a large Russian convoy, some 300 or more large tandem container trucks, was in Russia, headed for Donetsk in the Ukraine. And that the Ukrainians have said they will not let it cross the border. Now, the Ukrainians, the Kiev regime, at the direction of the United States and being funded by the United States, this is a government that is totally bankrupt. It is astonishingly corrupt economically. I mean, bribes are the only way that business is done in the Ukraine. It is a hideous society of thugs This is not a prize. This is a people and a state to be avoided at all costs. They are, you listen to their rhetoric, they are enraged idiots. I mean, if there were a people that you'd want to put the label savages on, this would be the place. I don't know why Russia is interested in them, but they are. Because, well, I understand, they're Russians. Anybody over the age of 20 was a Russian citizen. Anyone over the age of 40 spent most of their lives as a Russian citizen. They speak Russian. They want to be part of Russia. They want no part of the Kiev regime, which you can't blame them. And now you have the Kiev regime at being funded by America, being directed by America, sieging Donetsk, surrounding it, trying to starve the people to death, and bombarding them with artillery. America tongue lashes and puts sanctions on Russia for doing nothing. And so the Russians have decided that humanitarian relief is necessary. The people have no food, they have no water, they have no medicines. They're being besieged. The Russians say, you know, the least we can do is supply humanitarian relief. It's the same thing that any moral country would want to do. And the Ukrainians say, no, you can't drive those trucks in there. So they're at a standstill. There have been fears that Russia would use the convoy as a pretext for military action against the Ukraine. Well, that would only happen if the Ukraine continues to be belligerent, continues to bombard with artillery the largest city in Donetsk, the capital of that region. And that's exactly what they're doing, and also preventing the humanitarian aid to come in. If they do that, the Russians have no choice. They will escort the humanitarian aid with military vehicles. And if the Ukrainians, at the United States' insistence, as hotheads, as nincompoops, respond to use their military to prevent Russia from this humanitarian effort, and that'll be it for the Ukraine. That'll be it for the American premise of turning the Ukraine into a NATO ally. Some of the most reprehensible people in the world, certainly the most reprehensible non-Muslims in the world. Quote, provocation by a cynical aggressor is not permissible on our territory, Ukrainian Interior Minister Avkov said in his Facebook page. Provocation. Yep. Food is a provocation. Bandages are a provocation. Water is a provocation. But artillery bombardment of a civilian city is not provocation. That's how upside down this whole thing is. Prime Minister Yatsenyuk described the Russian move as boundless cynicism. I mean, when I say that this is the dumbest, most moronic government in the world today, I mean, that's hard when you consider Muslim states. Then when you consider how stupid the U.S. government is. But this, it takes the prize. That a 300 trucks filled with humanitarian necessities to ease the suffering of an ethnic Russian community that is being bombarded by artillery being fired from the Kiev regime, that has taken out water, has taken out electricity, has taken out natural gas, taken out the local refinery, that has made life unbearable there. That food, water, the necessities of life is boundless cynicism. First they deliver tanks, Grodd, rocket launchers, terrorists and bandits. Then they deliver water and salt, he said. What a piece of crap. And I despise the Kiev leadership. I am so angry at the United States of America for inspiring these hoodlums to launch a violent coup to take over the popular elected government, and then to supply them with tens of billions of dollars and military expertise to start this war. I am so disgusted that the United States of America is on the side of these hoodlums, these thugs. There is no indication that the Russians delivered tanks, rocket launchers, most certainly not terrorists and not bandits. In fact, there is no terrorist here other than the Kiev government. The ethnic Russians that are fighting for their independence from these thugs have not attacked civilians. They only attack the military, which is being used against them. So the terrorism is what is occurring now on the other side, with the military of the Kiev regime bombarding a civilian city. Now, the ethnic Russians are bandits in a way. Most of the weapons that they're using to defend themselves and to liberate themselves from this regime of scumbags in Kiev was taken from Ukrainian military bases. It's stunningly pathetic. What America has done is reprehensible. And the human carnage that has resulted is like almost everything else America does. You know, we are maneuvering for our own perverted, selfish interests have caused thousands of people to suffer and die. I told you this was going to happen. Dateline is Washington. The Pentagon has sent an additional 130 military advisors, except these aren't advisors this time. They're troops. To northern Iraq to help plan the evacuations of thousands of displaced people trapped by Sunni militants on Mount Sinjar, the Defense Department official said, indicating that the American force may be needed in the rescue attempt. To quote our conspiratorial sites, boots on the ground, baby. Mission creep. It was inevitable. That means that in terms of advisors, it's about 400 advisors. In terms of security personnel in Baghdad, there's another 500. That's just shy of 1,000. But that dwarfs in comparison to the United States operations in Baghdad. The State Department and CIA, which operate as one in most foreign countries, have more than 5,000 operatives in Baghdad, bringing the grand total to 6,000. So here's the Pentagon saying that, you know, yeah, there was 1.3 million Christians. Some say as many as 1.8 million Christians in Iraq at the time of the invasion who lived enjoyable lives. They had all the rights of an Iraqi citizen. They weren't harassed. Their churches were not terrorized. They could live normal lives, fulfilling lives in Iraq. And now there are 30,000 of them. They've been annihilated. The United States caused this. In fact, the United States was there as much of it was happening. And even when the United States had hundreds of thousands of boots on the ground, they did nothing to protect the Christians. Nothing. They were annihilated. And when the Islamic State went into Mosul, into Nineveh, into other communities in northern Iraq, and gave the few remaining Christians the Muslim option, convert to Islam or die, and he will give you one chance to, you can give up your home and flee. Otherwise, it's convert or die. America didn't lift a finger. Didn't do a damn thing. But when Zoroastrians are threatened, got some few thousand Zoroastrians, maybe it's 10,000, maybe it's 20,000 Zoroastrians that have been pursued by the Islamic State. Now we're going to intervene and we're going to put boots on the ground to rescue Zoroastrians. We're going to go start bombing to protect Zoroastrians.
I just have a question.
Yeah.
What is a Zoroastrian? This is actually the first time I've ever heard it. I've never
heard
the term before.
You know, I'm glad you asked that question. In fact, now that I'm going to go explain what a Zoroastrian is, you're going to think that everyone's going to think I set you up on this. Now, the scholars will tell you that Yazidi have combined Islam, Christianity, and the old Persian religious lore. That's what the scholars are all saying. Every article I've read, that Yazidi is a blend of Islam, Christianity, and the Persian religion. That's not true. Yazidi, actually, as a word, is a religious word. It's a Zoroastrian word. It's a word specific, just like jihad is a Islamic word. Yeah, I know it's an Arabic word, but if it wasn't for the Quran, Islam wouldn't have the group of people known as either Mujahideen or jihadists. It's a Quranic term. Well, Yazidi is a Zoroastrian term. It means worthy of worship. It identifies who they are. Syncretic religions would define Zoroastrianism, but it's not a blend of Christianity and Islam in the Persian religion. It is the official religion, the state religion, of the three Persian empires. The Achaemenid, the Parthian, and the Sasanian. The three, the old, the middle, and the new Persian Empire was the official state religion. And as we'll find out, it has commonality with Christianity only because Paul's affinity for Gnosticism. It has affinity for Islam only in the sense that Muhammad picked up on many of the ancient religious customs to create Islam. Islam is simply a blend of religious customs. Zoroaster, which that's the Greek and English version of his name, who may have lived, may not have. There's really no way of knowing whether this individual actually lived, because we don't even know within 500 years as to when he would have lived if he did. But he is said to have arranged a pantheon. By the way, having a religious founder that there is absolutely no proof that he actually lived is really irrelevant. And there isn't a single trustworthy account, including the Quran or the Hadith, the Sirah, the biography, or the Tariq history from Islam's past that provide any credible evidence that Muhammad lived. But it really doesn't matter. In fact, in Prophet of Doom, when I survey the credibility of the sources and said there's not one of them that's even remotely credible, that you say, but it really doesn't matter, because what matters is what people believe that person was like that are adherents of the religion based upon the text of that religion. So whether Muhammad actually lived or not is irrelevant. What's relevant is the Muhammad that is presented in the Quran and Hadith. That's what's relevant. Anyway, as it relates to Zoroaster, probably never did live, but there is a whole mythology about him, and he essentially blended the pantheon of Hindu and Babylonian gods. He was raised a Hindu, but he had an affinity for the Babylonian Assyrian gods, and he blended them into opposing forces. There were the progressive and the destructive forces. And that these two opposing groups of deities were under Ahura Mazda, who was called Illuminating Wisdom. And he was, at the time, an existing and well-known pagan deity. Darius, for example, before Ahura Mazda was even part of Zoroastrianism, had an affinity for Ahura Mazda because he was part of the Babylonian and then the Assyrian religion. Now, his religion did influence Gnosticism. It influenced Plato, and thus Gnostics, and thus Paul, and thus Christianity. It also influenced Judaism through Kabbalah. Kabbalah is Jewish rabbinic spiritualism, and Kabbalah and Zoroastrianism, the premise of the opposing forces, of the good and evil forces all fighting out, it's the basis of Kabbalah. The primary Zoroastrian threat in Islam is the singling out of one of many pagan gods, in this case, Ahura Mazda versus Allah, to be the primary deity while incorporating the religious mythology of the others to create a religion that was acceptable to the masses. That's exactly what Muhammad did. Allah was one of 365 stone idols in the rock pile that was known as the Kaaba. And Muhammad simply declared that he was the God and then incorporated all of the religious mythology of all of the pagan deities that were there into his new religion. Zoroastrianism is a syncretic blend identical to that. In other words, it established the basis for which Islam would later emerge. Now, if this opposing forces, progressive and destruction and destructive, sounds familiar to listeners in America who may have never heard of Zoroastrianism, it's the basis of the Star Wars religion. The dark side of the Force and the good side of the Force, it's exactly Zoroastrianism. So the Star Wars religion with the Force and the Jedi Academy and the enlightened individuals and channeling this Force, it's in fact, it's even interesting that in Zoroastrianism, someone who is like in Buddhism or Hinduism and removes themselves from society, becomes a monk or that sort of thing, completely discouraged in Zoroastrianism. If you're going to be a representative of the positive side of the Force, then you have to engage. You've got to do what the Jedi's do in Star Wars and be protectors of the galaxy. That's the only thing that the religion aspires to is that to motivate Zoroastrians to be protectors of the world through aligning themselves with the good side of this Force. So it is the if you understand the Star Wars religion, then you will understand Zoroastrianism because it was modeled after it. In the Zoroastrian religion, the peacock angel is a dominant figure and is equated with Satan by Muslims. And so Muslims have viewed for years the Zoroastrians as devil worshippers. Now, in the 7th century, the Sassanid Persian Empire was overthrown by Muslims. Now, that's important because prior to that time, the official, and in fact the imposed religion of the Persians was Zoroastrianism. So this is now the conflict. The beginning of the conflict is within a handful of years of Muhammad's death. The Muslims raided and conquered the Persian Empire. Now, the Persian Empire by that time was already on its heels because of its conflicts first with Greece, where it was pummeled, and then by Rome, where mostly the Romans and the Persians fought to a draw. But they beat each other up in doing so. So they were easy pickings by the time the Muslims came along. So in the 7th century, this is now 1,400 years ago. The Muslims overran Persia, and they Islamicized it. And under the Umayyad Caliphate, even Wikipedia says, in quotes, there was serious pressure exerted on the subjected people to leave Zoroastrianism, to denounce it, and to convert to Islam. Yeah, the pressure was the same pressure that is being applied today. It's exactly the same scenario. 1,400 years ago, the Zoroastrians, just as they are today, were told to convert or die. And for a very brief period, they said, you can leave, but you leave everything to us. Or you convert or die. It's exactly the same thing that is happening on that mountain in Iraq today, which is why it is just amazingly stupid that America would jump in to this 1,400-year assault and think that another few hundred boots on the ground is going to make a difference. We'll be back in a moment. So perhaps the United States, the nation that created the Star Wars series, is going in to rescue the Jedi Academy from the evil empire of the Islamic State. Well, whatever we're doing, it's foolish. The conquered Zoroastrians, as it relates to their history in Persia, were treated as dhimmis. Dhimmis is an Islamic term that describes abject humility, total subjection. A conquered people that are not willing to convert to Islam, once the Islamic barbarians have come in with their swords raised. According to the Quran's ninth surah, have to be humiliated to the point that they are subhuman. They have absolutely no rights. Their property is turned over to the Muslims. They're owned by the Muslims. They're lower than a slave. They have literally no rights. You know, in Islamic society, a woman is a piece of property. Oh, the dhimmis have less rights than women in Islam. And so the Zoroastrians were demeaned in this way. In exchange for tribute, which means turning over all of their possessions to the Muslims, and a complete loss of all status as humans, they could remain Zoroastrians so long as they did so privately. They could never have a symbol of their religion. They could be seen by others. They could never meet collectively. They could never promote their religion with anyone. They couldn't even discuss their religion outside of their homes. The jizya tax was leveled on them by all of the Muslim caliphates as dhimmis. It was used as a means to rob and humble all Zoroastrians, along with many laws that were imposed on the Zoroastrians starting 1,400 years ago. They were specifically designed to emphasize their inferior status. Under the early Orthodox caliphs, as long as the non-Muslims, the Zoroastrians, paid their taxes and adhered to the reprehensible, degrading Dhimmi laws, they were allowed to practice their religion privately in the land owned by, controlled by, these Muslim barbarians. 1,300 to 1,400 years after all of this occurred, now the U.S. intervenes in this long onslaught. Are we nuts? Are we completely ignorant of history? Do we know that by breaking Iraq apart, that this was inevitable? That we caused this problem? It's being perpetrated with our weapons in a country that was broken, that enabled this to occur, and that there is no resolution, there's no place you can put them where they'll be safe from the Sunnis or the Shiites. Anyway, a tradition evolved by which Islam was made to appear as partly Iranian. as a religion. An example of this is the legend of Hussein, the son of the fourth caliph, Ali, the grandson of Muhammad. He was said to have married a captive Saniyid princess named Sharbanu. Now, she was a completely fictitious figure, but fictitious figures play major roles in religious lore. And she was said to have borne Husan a son, who is now the fourth Shia Imam. And the thing that distinguishes Shia Islam from Sunni Islam is these mythical imams that are, by all practical accounts, reincarnations of the Prophet Muhammad. Now, they've claimed that the caliphate rightly belongs to them, these Shia imams and his descendants, and that the Umayyads had wrongfully wrested it from them. That's the break between Shia and Sunni Islam. The alleged descent from the Saniyid house to counterbalance the Arab nationalism of the Umayyad Muslims and the Iranian national association with Zoroastrian helped to mitigate the tensions. But it only mitigated the tensions amongst Iranians, amongst Persians, not amongst the Sunni Muslims, who now saw the, because of this myth, the Zoroastrians as allied with their principal enemy, the Sunni Muslims, or the Shia Muslims. And so it created a bigger rift, one that cannot be resolved.